Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel, NFL Week 13, Monday Night Football Edition. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, you'd think after 5 years, I could at least remember the name of this damn podcast when I make the opening announcements.
You had a lot of enthusiasm, so I hear if you're not necessarily directionally right, as long as you come with some pizzazz, the listeners will enjoy it.
The enthusiasm might have been there. The enunciation clearly left something to be desired, which apparently, given some of the feedback we received, people were slightly misled on Sunday in terms of where we elected to go with our best bet, but more about that a little bit later in the show. Thankfully, as we joked, we did not go with the Los Angeles Chargers, who were beaten like a drum by the New England Patriots. But Payne, another NFL week basically in the books, albeit with three games left to go. As always, on Monday mornings, we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, as we saw. I mean, I'm not quite sure what direction we want to go in to kick things off here, but I guess we have to heap praise on Baker Mayfield with the dominant first half he put together and the Cleveland Browns announcing with authority that they appear to be very relevant in the AFC.
That was the biggest game of the weekend, so no problem starting there, and I will joke around and say this. Are the Browns the most overrated 9-3 football team?
Well, they were the most overrated 8-3. They've now moved to the most overrated 9-3. But I can tell you, you look at their upcoming schedule, very interested to see what we'll get from them a week from today in a revenge setup against the Baltimore Ravens. That is for sure.
Yes. And that's tongue in cheek. And I think we both thought that the Titans were also very overrated. But getting to Baker Mayfield, and I think if you go back and listen to the breakdown of Cleveland and Tennessee from Thursday's show, all of the talking points pretty much came to fruition that, you know, Baker Mayfield is a different quarterback when he isn't pressured. And that was the key to that game. Prior to this week, Baker's passer rating was 77 points higher when kept clean, and the Titans pressured Mayfield once in the first half. Once. That was it. Three times for the entire game. All four first half touchdowns Baker threw came with no pressure. And the other element of that matchup that we discussed was how bad the Titans were defending play-action passes. Even referenced that Week 3 matchup against the Vikings because of the Stefanski and Kubiak relationship and the similar style offenses. And I believe it was Cousins having something like 16 yards per pass attempt off play-action in that Week 3 game against Titans defense. So you knew it was going to be a similar strategy here. Three of Baker's TDs came off play-action. And overall, I thought he was pretty accurate. Stefanski did a really good job moving Jarvis Landry around, had him inside, had him outside, used him in motion. I think it helped Baker Mayfield, who was 7% above expectation with his completion percentage. And then I thought in the first half, defensively, the Browns were good. Joe Woods loaded the box. Derrick Henry saw 8 or more man boxes, 40% of his carries. In the first half, that number ballooned even higher. And you look early on in that game, Titans didn't throw the ball on first down in the first quarter a single time. So, you know, it is what it is. Once Tennessee started passing because of the game flow dictating they had to, as expected, the Browns with three starters down in the secondary, they were torched. So, you know, I didn't love what Arthur Smith did there initially in that game and kind of caused them to get behind. And you had Humphreys with, I don't know what you want to call it, the drop there, which was ended up being pretty vital because it gets picked off by Stewart and you end up losing the game by a score. So that was a pretty big drop there from Humphreys. So to me, if I'm looking long term, the Browns need to get healthy in the secondary. I don't know if it's going to be a good secondary by any means this season, but if you can get to below average, it's going to help some things out. And the other thing that's very clear is Mike Vrabel's defense, something we pinpointed had an issue at the middle of last season, is a full-blown train wreck. And they don't get pressure. They can't cover in the back end. So that's not a very good combination. And I know Titans fans will be listening to this and be like, well, we're down Jadeveon Clowney. He gets pressure. And we're down Adoree Jackson, our best cover guy. Yeah, true. I don't know if those guys are going to return. And if they do, certainly not going to be 100% at any point this season.
Yeah, I mean, this team has some major problems. I mean, there's no doubt about it. When you look at the Titans, who are now very much in a heated race with the Indianapolis Colts to win the division, the Titans' schedule slightly more favorable. This team is extremely flawed. I was as stunned as you were to see them run consistently on first down rather than utilizing play action. We saw the effectiveness of Corey Davis and A.J. Brown once they got going, knowing that the Cleveland Browns secondary was their area of weakness. But hey, stubborn is what stubborn does, and we seem to see it with alarming regularity in the National Football League for a couple of these coaches that want to impose their will physically rather than trying to beat an opponent at their weakest spot. So credit to the Browns for coming with a game plan. I mean, exactly what you said, that Kevin Stefanski was going to learn from what his former employer, the Vikings, did earlier in the year in a game where they came up short against the Titans. And early on, that was exactly the case, getting Rashad Higgins, Jarvis Landry, and Donovan Peoples-Jones all involved. The crazy part about that first half could have been even more lopsided if Peoples-Jones doesn't drop a walk-in touchdown on the opening Browns drive where they have to settle for a field goal.
Yes, perfect in-cutting route. Baker hits him square in the chest, and Peoples-Jones just flat out drops it, negating about another 4 points from the scoreboard there, which neither refs were overly happy about.
Do we give the Detroit Lions credit for their comeback win against the Chicago Bears, or was that more a direct indictment of what Chicago didn't do over the final 9 minutes? As Daryl Bevel is the interim head coach, takes over, Matthew Stafford throws for 400 yards, the Lions erase a double-digit deficit, and are able to exact some measure of revenge for the game that got away from him way back in week 1.
Give Matthew Stafford some credit. That was a big 90-yard drive. And he's a magician in those spots. He's so fun to watch, you know, playing chase and catch up, which unfortunately for him seems to be the case a lot. But, you know, this is on Chicago. The Bears lost this game. And if you look, they're up 10 with 4.5 minutes to go. And the bright spot of your team is on the field, the defense. And the Lions are without their two best weapons in Galladay and Swift, who aren't even playing in that game. You have to hold the lead there if you're the Bears defense. But even past that, and we talked a little bit before we started recording, this is also on Nagy. Chicago's up 10, and the offense just got super conservative. 9 minutes to go, the Bears start their possession at the Lions 46. Run on first, run on second, get called for a hold. Short pass on second and long, incomplete on third, and you punt on fourth and four from the Detroit 39, and you gain about 30 yards of field position. Chicago gets it right back after a Lions 3-and-out, and you have the ball at your own 45. So again, another spot in the field where you should be attacking to end the game with your offense. Run on first, short pass on second, sacked on third. And so, you know, you're looking at Matt Nagy up 10 with almost 10 minutes left, 2 drives start at midfield. He didn't care about ending the game with his offense as an offensive-minded coach. So, you know, he wanted to be conservative and sit on the lead, and that's ultimately what ended up getting him beat.
It's so hard for Bears fans who now are seeing a lot of rumors circulating that Pat Fitzgerald may be atop the Bears' wish list. For as much as Pat has done as head coach of the Northwestern Wildcats, we've talked about it and we'll continue to do so until we're blue in the face, that you go after an offensive-minded head coach in this day and age, whether you're a college football program or in the NFL, because that's how you ultimately need to win games. But that's a different discussion entirely for a different day. As far as other good things you saw unfold so far this week in the National Football League, Payne, what's really stood out to you?
You know, let's talk about the Rams, because that was another game that we pinpointed as being, you know, a fun one for the weekend that had a lot of intrigue, that had a lot of impact on the NFC race. And I think we talked about it for 15 or 20 minutes on Thursday. And there was a battle in that game. We said sharp money on Arizona +3, but we agreed a little bit more with that initial move on the Rams -1. And we really liked Jared Goff's comments, taking responsibility for all the poor play. And he flat out said, he's like, hey, I wasn't offended by McVay's comments because the criticism was true. And I think even the telecast said, and I think you watched that game more than I did, but the telecast apparently interviewed Goff, as they do before the game, and he said, hey, I was a little depressed for about a day, sat in the house in the dark and, you know, kind of thought about some things. But once I stopped feeling bad for myself, I had a great week of practice. And so that's what we saw from Goff. McVay continues to own the Cardinals, now 7-0. But if you look at Goff specifically, wasn't pressured all that often, which is key for him, something we talked about, similar to Baker Mayfield. Goff was the most accurate quarterback this week so far, 10% above expectation, 65% of Goff's passes graded successful, 7.2 an attempt. Down to down, there was that efficiency where he was moving the chains, and then he also had four explosive passes. And so this was just a matchup where we saw two teams, both with everything to play for, trending in different directions. And matchup-wise, I didn't think it was overly positive for the Arizona side. Very upset. I ended up at the window there with a little bit of money on the Rams. But McVay continues to dominate these guys for the seventh time in seven tries. Hangs a 30-burger on him. So just a good day, I thought, for the Rams offense.
One thing I will say, and we talked a little bit about it, there hasn't been much to highlight in terms of Florida State football in any capacity over the last year or so. Cam Akers, to me, yesterday, Payne showed that he has to be the number one back. We talked a little bit, or I should say you did, about his vision, and he had that big confidence-building run last week. He's now become the first Rams rookie to run for a touchdown in three straight games. And with 21 carries, McVay put a little faith and confidence in him, saying, hey, look, you're going to be our guy. And that was in spite of the fact that we saw Darrell Henderson break off one of the bigger carries that changed momentum in that game. So you begin to wonder if the Rams have a running back that they trust, and I'm not putting Cam Akers in the Todd Gurley camp yet, how that much more dynamic this offense can be. One other thing that I'm not sure shows as important of the role as he played in that game in the box score, Van Jefferson appears to be a lot more comfortable. And if the Rams have three wide receivers and they get their tight ends involved, very interesting to watch this offense operate, because you talk about efficiency. They don't have that vertical big play passing threat, but if they can move pre-snap motion and everything else and pick up 6 to 8 yards a pop, it's a lot easier to move the sticks on third and two than it is third and seven, third and eight.
It certainly seems that the rookies are really starting to contribute, and they're starting to get their feet wet, and they have a better understanding of what's going on. And it's to be expected of good players that have potential this part in the season that they can start actually contributing, because we talked about the abbreviated offseason and how that would be even more difficult for some of the young guys. And then Cam Akers had some protection issues early on. He had a couple fumble issues. But if you can get the ground game going, the play action becomes, I think, even more of a factor for Jared Goff. And I know we talk about this being a team that likes to run three wide sets and pass the ball a bunch, but McVay also really likes to run the ball and establish the ground game. And I think that helps the offense. Van Jefferson, you mentioned, was a beast at Florida. And if he can provide that third option, all of a sudden you got some weapons. And then there was a Tyler Higbee sighting. They were unsure if he would play this week. You saw him out there look like, you know, the Terminator there with that elbow brace. But he played pretty well. And I think if you can get those guys acclimated to the offense and add them to Cooper Kupp and Woods, all of a sudden you have some really nice weapons there on offense.
Yeah, Higbee was good. Everett was good. They got contributions all over that offensive side, and it obviously translated on the scoreboard with the commanding victory within the division, moving them into first place in the NFC West, because we had a little bit of an upset take place in the Pacific Northwest. The New York Giants go on the road with Colt McCoy as their starting quarterback, plus 450 on the money line at FanDuel Sportsbook, and beat the Seahawks outright 17-12, mainly behind the legs and running ability of Wayne Gallman, who ripped off 16 carries for 135 yards, including a long of 60, when it looked like that Giants offense had been stuck in quicksand for the better part of the first half, mustering a grand total of 0 points.
What a terrible loss for Seattle. I mean, that's bad. Just one you can't have happen. I understand, okay, you don't play your best football, but somehow you eke out a win. Because they were in prime position, at least when you look at the schedule, right? The Giants, the Jets, Washington, you know, a beat-up San Francisco team. You do obviously have the Rams on the schedule, but it's at home. The schedule set up more favorably than it did for the New Orleans Saints, in my mind. So going out there and losing that game, now it's, I don't know if you have a shot at the one seed, which is obviously vital this year with only one team getting the bye. So that was a massive, massive loss. You mentioned Wayne Gallman. He was awesome. And I know you have the long run, which distorts some things. But even if you go, you know, 65 yards on the other 15 carries, it's enough against a defense like that, which has been stout against the run all year. But the more impressive thing about Wayne Gallman is he ran into 8-man boxes on 75% of his carries and still was efficient enough and obviously hit that long explosive. And to me, though, the biggest key was defensively. And that's one thing the Giants have been really good at this season. They've been trending even better. They really held Russell Wilson in check. They're able to get pressure with just four guys. And I think that was the big thing. One of the worst performances I've seen from Russell Wilson in a long, long time. I think he's fully taken himself out of the MVP race at this point. But if you look at the Giants defense, they hold Seattle to 4.6 yards per play and a 47% success rate overall. Russell Wilson himself, 4.3 yards per pass attempt, 45% passing success rate, only two explosives on the day. So just a fantastic job by the Giants defensively, and Colt McCoy did just enough on the offensive side of the ball to get the win here. So huge win for the Giants. Now first place in the division, control their own destiny, and man, Joe Judge has these guys confident and believing, and I think we joked about this last week, is regardless of how much talent is here, it seems that it is very clear the players have bought into Joe Judge, and this is actually one of the better coached teams in that entire division.
The Giants are 5-2 in their last seven games. Their two losses come by a grand total of 3 points. When you lose to Philadelphia on Thursday Night Football 22-21, you lose to the Tampa Bay Bucks on Monday night by 2 points there. We could be talking about the Giants in the middle of a seven-game winning streak with a little bit of luck, sitting at 7-5, and all of a sudden the narrative is a heck of a lot different about the NFC East. And you mentioned it. The Giants' schedule, yes, they're not going to be easy games, but three of their next four at home. Arizona this coming week, where they'll be short home underdogs. They get the Browns in what could be a very good spot a week from Sunday. Then they go out on the road, play the Ravens, and they wrap things up with the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, if you're the New York Giants, you have to be brimming with confidence thinking, hey, look, if we go 3-1 down the stretch and finish 8-8, this is our division to win, and we've arrived well ahead of schedule with a first-year head coach.
No question. When you look at what else is in the division and who they play, I mean, the Eagles' schedule is brutal down the stretch. Washington's schedule isn't any better, and that's including today's game. So the Giants are in the driver's seat, not just because of how well they're playing, which is the best in the division, but everyone seems to have a very difficult schedule down the stretch, so there isn't this really lopsided amount of games for the teams in the division. So you have to like what they're doing, and you hate to say this, but even the clapper there, Jason Garrett, has been somewhat respectable as a play caller. There has been some imagination over this current 5-2 run that we hadn't seen with his Cowboys offenses. So, you know, he hasn't been as bad as we initially anticipated he would be.
Nope, there is no doubt about it. So hat tip to the Giants, very much in the thick of things, controlling their own destiny in that division. With the good pain obviously comes the bad, but before we get there, I wasn't sure if there was anything else you wanted to highlight in the positive fashion from this past weekend.
No, I think we covered all the obvious ones, and, you know, touching on two games that we had broken down last week and seeing how those played out, I think we nailed those pretty well. And that's it. Let's get to the bad.
Well, the bad, I mean, there's probably one of two places we can start, and it can be at Lambeau Field with what we saw yet again from the Philadelphia offense for the better part of 2.5 quarters under the leadership of Carson Wentz, or we can start in Southern California where there looked to be a glorified scrimmage taking place at SoFi Stadium. I'm willing to let you go wherever you want here. I don't know if we keep going after the punching bag that Anthony Lynn has become now that Dan Quinn is no longer employed.
Yeah, let's start there. I mean, listen, we had Belichick against a rookie quarterback, and I believe in his career it was about a 65% cover rate. It's ultimately what kept us off the Chargers, despite the joke there that probably we should never make again. But
Hold on a second. Before we get into that, our listeners that tune in, we know there's a couple of you out there that tune in just for the best bet. Please at least listen to the best bet analysis. For those folks that thought we had the Chargers as our best bet on Sunday. If you would have taken more than 2 minutes out of your day to actually listen, you'd have known we were joking about that, and our best bet still has yet to take place for NFL Week 13. All right, I'm off my soapbox.
Yeah, probably in general, shouldn't joke about that, but we did obviously simply because
it's the Chargers.
The thrashing that I have given Anthony Lynn and the idea that that was the largest coaching mismatch of the entire week. So probably shouldn't joke about it, but we figured, or assumed rather, that going to the well with Anthony Lynn after bashing him for an entire week and the largest coaching mismatch was probably understood. Either way, what was clear here is that not only was Bill Belichick the better coach and he had the more prepared team, it looked like they quit on Anthony Lynn. Look like the Chargers players are done with Anthony Lynn. It'll be interesting to see what this line does against the Falcons this week, but that's the biggest thing. There's nothing to take away here. It was a 45-0 loss. The Chargers did not show up from the kickoff of that game, and it would appear at this point that they have quit on Anthony Lynn. And I don't know when he'll be fired, but he's obviously going to be fired. They don't respect their coach. And I get it, he's a nice guy, and we've said that all along, but he just has no clue what he's doing. And I think the players obviously know at this point that he has no clue what he's doing. And he's just a constant excuse box. Miscommunication. There wasn't communication on this. Well, it's your job as a head coach to get your guys organized. That falls on you. So we've also seen the offense regress with Austin Eckler's return. That shouldn't be happening, but basically what has happened is Anthony Lynn wants more running and more shorter passes to get Austin Eckler involved. And it's really hindered the offense across the board. So they haven't been able to figure out the smooth transition of Austin Eckler re-entering the offense. It should have been something that was just a bonus. It was an add-on, like, oh my God, we're going to get this weapon back. And our offense has improved since the bye, throwing the ball more. Just not a good scene here. And so there really doesn't need to be anything else said. If you're a Chargers fan, it is what it is. Anthony Lynn will be gone. And again, you have a franchise quarterback in a new home to pitch to an offensive guru to hopefully bring it.
Pick up the phone, call Joe Brady, ask him how many zeros it's going to take to lure him out of Carolina to come work with your young quarterback. This shouldn't be difficult. It shouldn't be rocket science. You have all the pieces to compete as early as next year if you're the Los Angeles Chargers. The fact this team is 3-9 with three wins against the Bengals, Jets, and Jags, not emblematic of the talent they have there in a beautiful new stadium, clearly one of the league's biggest disappointments when you look at their overall win total and where they should have been within the division. But it is what it is at this point. Sure. I'm always curious to get your take on that.
Let's say you go out and you get an elite offensive mind, whether it is Joe Brady or it's Lincoln Riley from the college level, and you implement a similar style as the Arizona Cardinals, saying, hey, Joe Brady, go be the offensive mind of this, and we will give you whatever you need, how much ever money to go get your defensive coordinator. And God forbid Denver fires Vic Fangio. If you were able to have Vic Fangio as just your defensive coordinator and Joe Brady as your offensive coordinator, we'd finally be able to bet the Chargers
every
season,
week.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the – if you're a Chargers fan, you're like hoping and praying that that could be the combination, and you would make a playoff push without question.
I mean, if you're the Spanos family, I don't even know who else is on your short list. And while I want to give some of these NFL franchises credit for how they go about their hiring practices, and I generally like to as well with major Division I college football programs, I see South Carolina going out there and getting Shane Beamer over the weekend. And just a lot of these things leave me scratching my head after talking to people close to the Oklahoma program. When Kirby Smart lets an assistant coach walk because he didn't recruit well enough to stay at Georgia, and South Carolina thinks that's a great idea, I know this is college in the NFL, it just has me going, how is this so difficult? And I know there's obviously logistics, but if you're the Chargers, you have to bring in an offensive mind. Justin Herbert, as young as he is, has to feel comfortable with the man that's going to lead this franchise, knowing that Herbert is the face going forward. Otherwise, you end up with a situation like we saw or we're seeing unfold in Chicago, where Mitchell Trubisky hasn't been that guy and most likely could be what makes Matt Nagy eligible for external employment at the end of this regular season as well.
And the key to this is prior to this week against New England, you've loved everything we have seen from Justin Herbert with inept coaching and game plans and scheme. So what happens when he's put in plus EV situations from an offensive mind like a Joe Brady or potentially a Lincoln Riley? We'll see. But that would be the home run combination, is that you go out and you hire an elite offensive mind, and he says to the defensive coordinator that he brings in, hey, go do your job. I'm not going to F with you. Just make sure the defense is good. And you could see a situation where I don't know if Denver ultimately fires Vic Fangio or if they give him another year. But
they should fire Drew Lock, is who they should fire, and John Elway for drafting deadbeats at the quarterback position, is what should happen.
Yeah, it's tough. He brought in a Super Bowl, and he's a Denver legend who's won two, so I don't know if he's leaving anytime soon. But if Vic Fangio is gone, he is an elite defensive mind. He is an elite defensive coordinator. And if you could pair him with a Joe Brady or Lincoln Riley, forget about it.
Yeah, pretty amazing when you look at two Stanford guys as general managers in the National Football League. What John Lynch is doing in San Francisco, working in conjunction with Kyle Shanahan, and the disastrous situation that John Elway's created. Because as you said, that elite defense brought them a Super Bowl. Peyton Manning put together a historic season, and the year they ultimately got over the hump and won it, it had nothing to do with Peyton. But it just goes to show sometimes that, hey, look, you can't let one result kind of mask the overall direction of the program as a whole. But another coach, Payne, who I don't think he's going to be out looking for a job, but you never know what Howie's going to want to do in Philadelphia. Doug Peterson, quietly making his own bed as Carson Wentz continues to flounder leading this offense. Another miserable performance for the better part of two and a half quarters from this Eagles offense before Peterson pulls the plug, goes to Jalen Hurts, and at least provides a spark for an otherwise dormant Eagles attack.
So everything that we have been talking about here in regards to Philadelphia and Carson Wentz specifically unfolded again. And he just is not confident. He is not seeing things. When he does see it, he's not ripping it and letting it go. Too much thinking. And, you know, if you look at this past week's game through the first three quarters, which is Carson Wentz time, 4.2 yards per pass attempt, 29% success rate for 113 pass yards. Even the throw to Dallas Goedert is one of those, like, get me over fastballs, so to speak, where if he throws it with confidence and leads Goddard, Goddard's still running. But Goddard has to wait on the ball and then come back to it. And by that time, a defensive back catches up to him. The game plan was pretty obvious from the onset. It's like, hey, we're going to play keep away here. We're going to be able to run the ball. They couldn't really do that. When they went to heavy sets, they had some success, but Doug Peterson decided not to do that enough either. So we've been talking about this. It's kind of this mesh of Doug Peterson regressing a little bit as a play caller, regressing a little bit as a schemer of systems. And you start to wonder, you've lost a lot of those guys that were on the Super Bowl roster. You know, Frank Reich is gone. John DeFilippo is gone. So we haven't seen that level of creativity, and we aren't doing things offensively that we're best at. You know, Zach Ertz returned. We've seen Richard Rodgers perform very well filling in for Zach Ertz, and we know what Dallas Goedert is, one of the best tight ends in all of football. And still we're not going with heavy sets. One of the best plays of the entire day comes from a heavy set using play action and having one read basically for Carson Wentz to where the brain doesn't melt down like a computer processing. And we don't do that enough. And that was the one area where the Packers defense has been horrific this season. It's defending heavy sets. Just makes no sense. I don't know. My feeling is we're going to see Jalen Hurts, but certainly a tough matchup for a rookie quarterback getting thrown into the fire against the Saints defense. But he certainly provided a spark, comes in. You have the touchdown to Greg Ward Jr. there, and you see the entire team just raise up. The defense got three consecutive stops after Jalen Hurts entered the game. You get the special teams return touchdown. So for the first time in a long time, it looked like there was a lot of pep in the step of some of those Eagles players. So it'll be interesting to see what Doug Peterson ultimately decides for this upcoming week.
Yeah, pretty interesting to see how the Eagles will play out the stretch, but clearly there has to be a change. And as you mentioned, when you're going head-to-head with arguably the best defense in the NFC right now, in the form of the New Orleans Saints, you better make sure you bring your A-game, because Carson Wentz standing in the pocket like a statue could become a sitting duck. Jalen Hurts at least gives you the option to create some mobility and provide some unique looks that the Saints would have to break down in film that they otherwise haven't seen. Last but not least, when we look at the ugly department, you know, we're often critical of some of the things we see. And in the heat of the moment, hey, look, these coaches and organizations are going to be prone to making some bad decisions here and there. But how does Vic Fangio justify punting the football to Patrick Mahomes on fourth and short, right around midfield with 6 minutes to go in the game, knowing you're a 2-touchdown underdog? Yeah, getting the ball back for Drew Lock with no timeouts with a minute and four to go, knowing he had to drive the length of the field. Clearly, I can't see what could possibly go wrong in that type of scenario.
Vic had a very good defensive game plan, which should not be shocking in the least. And I know Mahomes and the Chiefs are kind of just going through the motions, and I don't want to say dicking around, but they're certainly trying some things. Let's just put it that way. They are in experiment mode. We're going to see what Le'Veon Bell looks like. That experiment, I think, went by the wayside there because Darrell Williams was the horse there late in that game during crunch time. So we're going to try some trick plays here. I mean, the only reason that game is close is because of what Vic Fangio's defense did, holding, you know, KC to field goal after field goal inside the 10 multiple times. Offensively, though, he's not the best, obviously, making decisions. Now, he's not the guy calling the plays, but he's ultimately making some of these decisions. And it's not just the late decision there, Todd. But you think about the onset of the game. You settle for a field goal to start the game. It's like, it's fourth and 1.5. Do you think you're beating Patrick Mahomes with field goals? So this is why I don't hire defensive-minded coaches as my head coach, for multiple reasons. One, because every decision seems to be based on what makes my defense look better. So if we can get that punt and pin, now all of a sudden my defense is going to look better if the offense has to drive 70, 80, 90 yards. The decision-making process is all based upon what looks best for my defense and not what the actual right decision is. And then, you know, to take it one step further, as we know, if one of these defensive-minded guys is able to hire a very competent offensive coordinator, he's going to get picked off in a year or two. And you're constantly changing your system or having to hire guys and make the right hire. So this is why I don't hire defensive guys as my head coach in 2020. It makes no sense. But this is what you get. And it should be expected. And it's not shocking. And we can kind of yell into the clouds, so to speak, here on how bad some of these decisions are. But you see it week after week. And it's not going to change until you make a change at head coach.
Anything else that we've left off the table in terms of the negative variety before we move on to just a couple of look-ahead lines, as there hasn't been a whole heck of a lot of movement from week 13 to looking ahead to week 14?
No, I mean, I think that pretty much covers it. New Orleans-Atlanta was a game that I watched a little bit. Taysom Hill looked very competent, and honestly, despite some sharp money being on Atlanta early in the week at 3.5 and 3, there was a difference of opinion. We did see a little bit of a sharp money buyback there on New Orleans -2.5, and that was the dead right side. Taysom Hill was good early on in that game, and in fact, it's 21-9. Taysom and the Saints are going down to score to make this a really lopsided game. I think as I'm watching this, it said something to the effect of the Saints having like over 400 yards and Atlanta having 150, and then Taysom Hill fumbles, and then all of a sudden we have a game here. So I don't think that game was as close as the final score indicated. Other than that, there wasn't anything that was too crazy to me. One of the look-ahead games I know we'll talk about based upon the number was Jacksonville-Minnesota. That was an odd game to me, as I watched pretty much every snap of that. But Jacksonville, what you can give them credit for is they have not quit on the season. Those guys are playing hard for Doug Marrone. Apparently he is going back to Glennon again. I don't know why, but maybe there's something else at play there. But, you know, Jacksonville has the drive to start the game. They have the drive to end the game to send it in overtime. Aside from that, the offense wasn't very good. So that game probably shouldn't have been that close. I see on your sheet here, ugly field goal kickers. Would you like to vent about those?
You know what? I mean, I thought I did, but I felt like yesterday getting in my car after some of those games was a little more cathartic experience. But when you miss not one extra point, but two, when we take the best of the number in a game between the Eagles and Packers. It's sure, we can say it probably had no business going over the opening total at 46.5, but two missed extra points, hard to handicap in any capacity. And then you look around the rest of the league. Dan Bailey, I'm not sure what the hell was going on in Minnesota. 51-yard field goal made Joey Sly look like he was right on line the week before, with the Carolina Panthers coming up just short in the game in Minnesota, but he was nowhere close. And I really thought, and we're going to get to it, like you said, between with the Jaguars and their next opponent, but I thought the Vikings were going to go for it on third and short from the 1 yard line in overtime because they had so little confidence in Dan Bailey's ability to kick a game winning field goal. But the list goes on, and I'm not going to oversimplify it, but you have one job to do. These kickers missing an abundance of extra points. I really believe going forward, Payne, you're going to see a lot more coaches look to go for two than we ever have in NFL history.
So the league made a great adjustment pushing these back because there's actually some intrigue now. You can't just...
Had no idea it was going to create this many missed field goals. I laugh when that rule change came down that it was going to somehow create anything different than what we'd already seen as the gimme. But hey, I was wrong. I admit it. I was completely and utterly wrong in that regard.
It's suddenly a play that you're just not, you know, hopping up off the couch and going to the fridge to get a beverage or to the pantry to grab a snack. Like, you are watching that PAT now because it's so important, and certainly made some of the key numbers a little less relevant, a few others a little more relevant. And it's certainly frustrating, without question, when you start to get the best of the number there and some of those PATs are missed. Yeah, you are right there. That the Eagles game had really no business going over based upon the start of that game, how slow it was, the ground game that Doug Peterson employed, and then when you take Jordan Howard off the practice squad and make him active, you're saying to yourself, Jesus, is this really going to be the game plan here? But despite that slow start, you still had an opportunity to get to halftime 14-6, but Carson Wentz takes sacks on back-to-back plays, knocks you out of field goal range. At 14-6, you're like, you know, we're not in too bad of a spot. And then you get MVS with the drop pass that would have set you up first and 10 around about the 15-yard line. And instead, it's a punt. So, you know, then you get the Boston Scott long run, and you get the phantom holding call. But yes, aside from that is, you know, I always take pride in, obviously, winning is important. But our job at this point is getting the best of the number. And at that point, that's technically our job. Like, I'm not getting out there and running for touchdowns or kicking field goals. So it's not like the stock market. And that's what we've always joked about. If this was the stock market where you can just buy and sell and that's all you're worried about, you never lose. Unfortunately, you know, you're relying on the 18-year-old kid to carry out your job, so to speak, after you've gotten the best of the number. And so, you know, without divulging too much, that was a total that middle of the week that we originated and went over 46.5, and felt good seeing another group come in after us and say, hey, 48 isn't enough. Let's push this thing out to 50.5. And at that point, I get a little tingling feeling below the belt that the good number wins and every other number loses. Probably shouldn't think that way, but, you know, that thing falls 47. Well, I feel really good.
Well, you know who's not going to have a good feeling, Payne? And we didn't take the low-hanging fruit with an ugly. We've had a firing this morning in the National Football League breaking just moments ago.
I don't know who it is, but it can't be Adam Gase because they're employing him to lose games, which seems to be going swimmingly well.
Adam Gase, however, you're close. You're in the right franchise, but the wrong coach.
Really?
They've decided to part ways with defensive coordinator Greg Williams, as per Adam Schefter.
Wow. That's interesting.
So it goes.
So they
to
actually
show.
Tried winning that game. That wasn't from up above. Like, hey.
Well, hold on a second. Conspiracy theorists out there, maybe they didn't aspire to win the game, but to try and cover up the errors of their ways, they had to make Greg Williams the fall guy, like you see in every good conspiracy movie.
Chris Carter says you need a good fall guy. So yeah, I mean, they went cover zero without both their starting corners and on third and a mile when the only thing that could beat you was a touchdown. We just all assumed that was a call down from the GM. Said, hey, like, you know, we'd like Trevor Lawrence here. Let's try to figure out how to botch this game late. But no, apparently that was all Greg Williams' choice, or they're at least making it look that way by by firing him on a Monday morning. That's interesting.
Even more impressive, Adam Gase continues to dance between the raindrops. That man is living a charmed life, and I'm going to laugh if he's ultimately retained as Jets head coach going into 2021 as well.
No, there's no way he's going to be retained. This is just a, in my mind, they're saying to themselves, like, this guy's so inept, his offense is so bad. We know how beat up our defense is. Like, this guy's going to take us to the Trevor Lawrence promised land here. And so there's no reason to fire him at this point.
Oh, you love the storylines that you see unfold, even sometimes when you don't love the results in the NFL. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. A couple of minor adjustments in terms of look ahead numbers, Payne, at FanDuel. The Titans projected out to be a 9.5-point favorite for their road date against the Jacksonville Jaguars in the wake of Jacksonville losing by the narrowest of margins in overtime to the Vikings. And the Titans getting blown out, at least theoretically, by the Cleveland Browns. I know the 41-35 final scoreline doesn't suggest that. You've seen a 2.5-point move from that nebulous zone in 7.5 to 9.5 down to the Titans, a touchdown favorite.
I won't break your balls, but we're now out to 7.5. So we've gone from 7.5 to 9.5. But one thing I will say.
No, 9.5 down to 7, yes, now yes. It's 7.5.
Yes, yes, so. Sorry. So we're now kind of in that area where...
You know, we were before.
Yeah, not a ton of movement there. Again, I'll say this. Jacksonville's playing tough. If you throw on the tape, like they're playing hard. The defense is flying around, not always in the right direction, and not always with a ton of talent, but they're playing hard. And that's something that they were able to really contain Cooks yesterday. And so let's see if they're able with that intensity and fight to give Derrick Henry a tough time. Now, that might not be a bad thing, right? If Arthur Smith wakes up and can't run the ball, you might actually throw it here against the Jacksonville secondary that is also decimated by injury. So that'll be interesting. We know that game was extremely tight earlier in the season with Jacksonville going on the road. That was Gardner Minshew, of course. But you're looking at Tennessee's defense. I don't know what they are. I know they're bad, but let's see if Glennon's able to move the ball. I was looking a little bit earlier today. Could be some wind there, about 15 miles per hour right now, but nothing too crazy there. I don't have anything on this game at this point. So, yeah, it's kind of where I'm at.
Falcons, Chargers, we've seen that number move across the zero, not to any key numbers, but the Chargers on a look-ahead number at FanDuel Sportsbook were a one-point favorite. You now see Atlanta, 2.5-point road favorites as they'll make their inaugural trip to SoFi Stadium.
Again, not a game that at this point I have anything on. I would certainly think the value hunters would be looking at the Chargers here. I would probably need three to consider it, and I think we joked about this off-air a little bit. It's like there's not a team in the NFL that's played better, more meaningless football games than the Atlanta Falcons the last few years. We've seen
it's them. An art form. It's an art form.
We've seen them surge late last year. Again, we're seeing that surge. Really, the only team that's given them a ton of trouble with Raheem Morris as head coach is the New Orleans Saints. It's just a bad matchup, it would appear, that the pressure is just too much for Matt Ryan. And offensively, it's just a very difficult matchup. That's just what that game feels like to me. That on paper and on the field, that's possibly the worst matchup that Atlanta could have. So they have done well. And if you break some things down, you look at EPA and you look at things under Raheem Morris, the Falcons are one of the better teams in football, as crazy as that is going to sound. But that's what the EPA numbers would indicate with Raheem Morris. So I understand why this is happening. And we also mentioned that it doesn't feel like the Chargers are necessarily playing for Anthony Lynn. We'll see if that changes this week after an embarrassing loss, you know, losing 45-0. You know, you have to have a little pride in your job. So we'll see what comes of this. But certainly Atlanta is a far better team than the 4-8 record. And I think that's, you kind of hinted at who are the Chargers' only wins this season? Who are they against?
Cincinnati, Jacksonville, and the Jets. A true murderer's row of opponents.
So if you have a team that is not playing for its head coach and has no motivation, It's difficult. And we're also looking at this, and we've talked about this for a couple of years now, is you're looking to back the Chargers as dogs, not as favorites. And they are a dog here. You're looking at 2, 2.5. But you're not going into this game saying, hey, I'm going to back the Chargers here, hope they lose by one. Like, this is a game that you're going into. Until it gets to 3, if it does get there at all, this is a game where you're saying, hey, look, the Chargers are going to have to, you know, win this game. So that's the difficult part of it here for me at this number.
That's about it in the way of looking at numbers.
Yeah, nothing
no
changed
real.
Much. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, not a lot of comprehensive changes. Thankfully, there were no major injuries as well. Any week you can get through the NFL slate and not see key contributors on either the offensive or defensive side of the ball nicked up with season-ending injuries or something that'll keep them out of long term, it's always a good thing. Obviously,
you did have like the 1 point move from 14.5 to 13.5 on the Jets Seahawks, but obviously, right? That's, you know, the Seahawks losing at home outright as a double-digit favorite, and the Jets covering a number. So you're going to make some minor adjustments to your power numbers there, and that's how you get to, like, you know, 13.5 minus 15 versus a 14.5. But other than that, like, there really wasn't much movement this weekend.
Pretty impressive when you consider that the Giants with Colt McCoy, 12-point dogs, the Jets in their current state, albeit now with a new defensive coordinator most likely, coming into next Sunday's game, only 13.5-point dogs, 1.5 suggests on a neutral. Of course, plenty of things to handicap and break down. You wonder if Seattle can get things right, knowing that they should probably go back to letting Russ cook instead of just pounding their head into a brick wall and running the football. But we'll see where these numbers ultimately settle. However, we do have a pair of games tonight, Payne, and the early one will kick off at 5 Eastern at Heinz Field, where the Steelers on short rest will welcome in the Washington football team. And right now at FanDuel, you're looking at the Steelers, a 6.5-point favorite. Total in this game sits at 43.5. We've seen some over money come in, and we've seen some dog money come in. I guess the first thing I want to ask you about when we try and figure out how to quantify a rest advantage, the Steelers, very short turnaround. Washington has been off since Thanksgiving. Does that impact the numbers in terms of how you look to set this, or is that more of an X's and O's handicap that, hey, look, we're going to give a team that's had a longer time to heal up a little bit of an edge in this particular spot?
Yeah, it absolutely has to be factored in, and this is partly why we've seen this line trickle down is that scheduling advantage. You know, you have a veteran staff with Ron Rivera and Jack Del Rio coming off a mini-bye, and the last time we saw them was playing Thanksgiving Day. Meanwhile, you have the Steelers, and they've been dealing with scheduling issues. They weren't sure when they were going to play last week. Now you only have 4 days off between games, and you're, you know, a pretty veteran team at some key spots. Then you see Big Ben not practicing, and he was added to the injury report. And that's the added reason that, you know, this game, when it opened 10, lasted for, you know, a few short moments, and now you're looking at 6.5 and even some 6. You would think at this point, though, that the number really doesn't have value in itself, right? Like, the situation is more than accounted for. Now you also have Bud Dupree that was out for the season. You have starting center Marquise Pouncey still dealing with the COVID situation. They said that he would have to figure it out by 4 o'clock today. So, you know, about 5 hours from now, they would figure out if Marquise Pouncey was able to go. Obviously, that's your starting center. He'd be huge to get back. But at this point, we're operating under the impression that he's not playing because no one said anything any different. So, you know, you hit on this Friday afternoon. We saw some sharp money over. It came in at 42. All of the remaining 7.5 was taken as well. And so, you know, at 6, 6.5, I don't see much in terms of value. It does look like a big boost for Washington is that Morgan Moses is going to play. Terry McLaurin, who's been battling through some ankle issues, is going to play. What's interesting to me about this game, and it's, you know, there's a lot of variance in my mind despite the low total. What are we getting from Big Ben? You know, the strength of Washington's defense is their line, fourth in both pressure rate and pass rush win rate. But can they get to Big Ben? Because Big Ben gets it out quick. We've talked about this multiple times this season. We talked about it in the preview podcast and how this offense would change. 2.28 seconds Big Ben's releasing the football. It's the quickest time in the NFL. So is Washington's pass rush going to be as effective? Now, you do have Jack Del Rio, right? Extra time to prepare. He has a little bit of a blueprint here. He saw his division mate, the Cowboys defense, who stinks, really give Pittsburgh some trouble. And you know, again, we've talked about Big Ben. The goal of this season, I think, for him was just to kind of be average, and the Pittsburgh Steelers would be good. So far, he's been just about average when you look at a lot of the metrics. But if you really dig into some of the tape, you really dig into some of the film, and it's starting to kind of leak out there now by a lot of the other analytical guys, is Big Ben's passing tree, it's not all that advanced. It's basically short and intermediate to the outside, and he takes the occasional deep shot. He has really stopped throwing to the middle of the field. He's not reading the middle of the field. It's really interesting to watch that you would think someone would maybe catch on to that, maybe with extra time. Washington's the team to figure that out. On the other side, just kind of quickly going over this, you have Alex Smith. It's a great story. And Todd, you and I have talked about this. He looks semi-competent. Just getting out there and getting back out on the field is an accomplishment in and of itself. But, and I'm going to put this the nice way, like,
he's not good.
You know, he's been okay. Like, he knows where the ball needs to go. He's a professional. The guys respect him. He is semi-accurate. He gets the ball to where the offensive coordinator wants it to go, where the play is designed. He can help your offensive line recognize protection issues and where the blitz is going to come from. Something, you know, Dwayne Haskins has had trouble with. But bottom line here, this is a huge step up in class, right? The three defenses Alex Smith has started against so far this season, it's Detroit, Cincinnati, and Dallas. 30th, 29th, and 24th in defensive efficiency. Now you get Pittsburgh number one. If you look at how Alex Smith throws the ball, it's virtually all short passes, and a ton of those go to running backs. Only 9% of Alex Smith's throws right now have gone 20 or more yards. Alex Smith is average intended air yards per pass. It's 4.7 yards. It's the least in the NFL by 1.1 yards. Drew Brees, the check down king, 5.8 intended air yards per pass. That's the second lowest. So think about that. Like, Alex Smith is a full yard below what Drew Brees is. And everyone's like, Drew Brees has no arm. He's captain check down. That's basically what Alex Smith is right now. And why that's important to mention is the Steelers defense is fantastic defending short passes and passes to running backs. So, you know, Washington's probably going to have to rely on their newfound ground game, but that could be obviously tough going against Pittsburgh's defensive front. I know certainly Baltimore has shown an ability to run on Pittsburgh, but really that's the only team that's been able to run on Pittsburgh. And the one thing they have is a mobile quarterback. Even RG3 was mobile enough. Neither of those, you know, guys are going to be confused for Alex Smith. Alex Smith isn't creating an advantage in the box by running it. So that's really the only team that's shown an ability to run the ball against Pittsburgh. Maybe now, right, with 4 days rest time and an advantage with rest, maybe that's a spot where they control the trenches a little bit and you hope to establish the ground game. But I'm not on this game. Let's just put it that way. I'm going to respect the over money. I'm going to respect this move down to 6. But certainly at this point, I don't see any value in the over or the Washington football team there. That's just my personal opinion. So I'm going to sit it out on the sidelines. I will say I completely understand it. You have a Pittsburgh offense that's been hanging some points this year, and you really want to get at the Washington defense in the first half because Jack Del Rio has made some very good adjustments. It's an average defense in the first half. It's really a good defense in the second half. So whatever Jack Del Rio is doing there to make some adjustments has worked pretty well. But, you know, I get it, right? If you look this season, right now, the average total being set by odds makers on some of these games for the entire season is 49.5. And you're at 48.4 points scored. So this is really a low total for today's standards. And you have a Pittsburgh offense that's been shooting through a lot of these numbers when they care. But, man, I'm not running to go over 43.5 here, Todd.
Going to be interesting. You talk about the injuries that Pittsburgh's dealing with on the defensive side and how this team is extremely good as far as a pass defense standpoint. when you look at Washington, they've clearly found their lead back in Antonio Gibson, but there's no doubt Alex Smith, part of the reason that those air yards aren't there, because they flat out can't protect quarterbacks, and it's not just Alex Smith. It was the same thing with Dwayne Haskins early in the year and Kyle Allen. The offensive line being a little bit of a weakness, always problematic. It will be interesting, like you said, to watch the other side of the ball, knowing that Washington has been prone to giving up the big play, a league-high 12 plays of 40-plus yards for as good as their defense has been in that second half. And I was blown away by this stat, Payne. When you look at Big Ben, I know he's only been sacked 10 times, but Roethlisberger has gone 199 straight dropbacks without being dropped for a loss. So we'll see if Washington can do anything to make his life slightly more difficult here, because the knock on Big Ben for all those years was that he hung onto the ball for way too long in the pocket and was unwilling to get rid of it. We'll call it the Carson Wentz syndrome in 2020.
Yes. Again, that's kind of the interesting part to this whole thing is Big Ben obviously on the injury report with a knee. Missed some practice. Again, it's a short week, but this has kind of been his schedule. Wednesday is a non-throwing day for Big Ben in a traditional work week. So him missing Saturday did not send any like, oh my God, he might not play here signals to me. And that's when this line started to go, which was bizarre. Because the guys, you would think, on the other side of the counter would have been cognizant of that. Now, obviously, some very sharp money here on Washington. And again, not just the guys who are able to pick off some numbers with lower limits at open, but, you know, the initial position, the large one from a well-respected group came in at 7.5. And then you even saw some guys, you know, grabbing the 7. And that's why we're sitting here, you know, at 6.5 and 6 this morning. So, you know, nothing for me at this number, but certainly fun nonetheless to have a little bit of football at 5 o'clock. Do we want to discuss Buffalo and San Francisco a little bit more?
I mean, do you want to add it? I'm more than happy to let you add to some of the analysis we provided, albeit briefly, in our best bet breakdown on Thursday. Wasn't sure how deep a dive you wanted to do for this game, because I don't think we're going to come back and tell people that we're looking for a scalp on Buffalo plus 1.5 now.
No, of course not. But you know,
busting balls there, Chris. Hold on. We're busting balls for people out there listening. We are not coming back with a bet on Buffalo trying to middle around the 1. I don't want anything to be misconstrued. Okay, Payne.
So, to your point, though, it is kind of funny, right? We gave out San Francisco last Thursday as the best bet plus 1.5. And we said that we thought they would close the favorite. And this morning you're looking at, you know, they're about a 1.5 point favorite. Some of the sharper shops did get to 2. You know, you're certainly not changing your mind. But in saying that, like with NFL games being able to end in a tie, the 1 is far more valuable in the NFL than it is at the college level. And I think if you would, you know, extrapolate that out over time, and we had a larger sample size, now that we have also dropped overtime to 10 minutes, and we have also dropped overtime to a scenario where if the initial team gets a field goal, you can still come back and retie the game with a field goal. You know, the 1 is certainly going to be maybe even a little bit more valuable than it would be in years past. So, you know, even though this has gone through 0, it's still, you know, a decent little move here. We talked a little bit about this game last week, but I will say, just kind of digging into it a little bit more and divulging a little bit more now at, you know, at this point where our money's fully in this game, so I feel a little bit more comfortable doing that. I don't know what the Bills offense is going to look like here. And certainly this total coming down from an open of 48 down to 47 and having a Bills total even open in the 40s is interesting. Josh Allen in the Bills organization had a little bit of a scare when Bosa tackled him funny, and he's been on the injury report with an ankle and a knee all week. Now, he's absolutely going to play here. He still has a monster arm, but you start to wonder if Josh Allen's 100% for this game. The other game within the game here that I didn't divulge last week, but it's worth mentioning, is defensive coordinator Robert Saleh. We talk about familiarity and blueprints a lot, but Robert Saleh's mentor is Gus Bradley. And Gus Bradley put together a pretty solid game plan up in Buffalo week 12. And so I think he's going to mirror and mimic a lot of those things. And Josh Allen in that game was held to 157 passing yards, only 2 explosive passes. John Brown, we know, is out. Gus Bradley also held Buffalo to 5% below their season-long success rate in passing. So now you get, you know, Robert Saleh potentially using that blueprint from his mentor, Gus Bradley. He's had a little bit more time to change some things. He's looked at the film and said, hey, this is how Buffalo reacted to what we were, you know, to what Gus Bradley was doing and what our defense could possibly do. Now let me throw in a little bit more to counteract that. We also saw Buffalo had to change things schematically on offense once they couldn't protect early in that game. So it'll be interesting to see all of those things. The one area where, and Todd, we talked a little bit off air, is San Francisco's defense had some problem against mobile quarterbacks. But if Josh Allen isn't 100%, maybe that gets negated a little bit as well. You know, take nothing away from Brian Daboll also in Josh Allen, and that offense has been very, very good. But there's also a little bit of a scheduling difference here on this side of the ball. San Fran, you know, despite their lack of health all season long, ninth in defensive efficiency. They've played a top 10 schedule of offenses. Buffalo's played the second easiest schedule of defenses. So that is something to look for. I have to say, like, I looked at this game, and for the first time all season, I found a lot fewer advantages for the Bills' offense than I've had at any point this season. Now, the one thing to kind of focus in on here is Cole Beasley. That makes me a little bit nervous, knowing that Kawan Williams, the 49ers slot corner, is out. But let's see if Cole Beasley can take advantage of a backup in the slot there. The other thing that's worth mentioning here, and I think we've talked about it for years and years now, is the circadian rhythm. Right before we started recording these podcasts, and you know, I think it was 2014, there was a public study done. There hadn't been some public studies done, but in 2013 there was, and they did a lot of back testing on this. It was that West Coast teams were winning these games at a 66% clip. A lot of that was attributed to obviously the body clock, which is very important. But what they kind of said was they believe the West Coast teams have these advantages because of the alertness and all the mental errors. The body would be, you know, less alert and more mental errors would ensue. And that's why they would be a little bit out of rhythm. So something to think about there. I can tell you we value it. We attribute some points to that happening. We already talked about the offensive side of the ball. That was more so the breakdown when we gave out the best bet. But you're getting back Debo, Ayuk, and Mostert. They're playing together for just the second time all season together. The other time they played together was back in week 6 when they beat the Rams by 8 as a 3.5-point opening dog.
So, and keep in mind, in that game, they only played together for the first half. It wasn't even the full game, so the numbers are misleading there in that Sunday nighter against the Rams.
That's right. Mostert went out right before halftime, tried to tape it up and test it out that first possession of third quarter, but just couldn't do anything.
Yeah, pissed me off. I had over his rushing totals in the low 70s. Dude has 65 at halftime and can't go out there to gut out a 7-yard carry. I was not too thrilled, Payne.
That's the other advantage there a little bit offensively as well, is that ground game. Despite Mostert, I believe at this point he's qualified for total rush attempts, but he's right now averages the most yards per rush in the history of the NFL right now. So he's only played in 5 games, yet San Francisco's 12th in rush efficiency. Buffalo defensively, that's where they've struggled a little bit. 22nd defensive rush efficiency. So there should be some areas there where, you know, Kyle Shanahan's exotic run offense has some success. Basically, in my opinion here, if Nick Mullins doesn't throw up on himself, we're going to be pretty good.
Well, it should be awfully interesting to try and see those two games unfold. It's nice to have a doubleheader to try and take advantage of. Hopefully, all of our listeners were able to get the best of the number with the San Francisco 49ers as a slight underdog. If they haven't, it's still not too late to add a little excitement to your sports watching experience by betting all of your action on the FanDuel Sportsbook app this season. There's a reason why FanDuel is America's number one sportsbook. The app is simple to use, great odds, different betting markets, unique fun bet types like same game parlays that you can take advantage of, and exclusive, always available promotions. Right now, FanDuel is letting you place your first bet risk-free up to $1,000. Use the promo code BETTHEBOARD. Take full advantage of those offers where sports betting is available for you. Payne, I know we have a game on Tuesday. I didn't really do a whole heck of a lot. Wasn't sure if you wanted to add a quick tidbit that our listeners can take advantage of for the Ravens and Cowboys game. Obviously, don't think it's worth doing a full breakdown since we're still not quite sure who may or may not be available for Baltimore.
Yeah, candidly, the number just became widely available yesterday, and you know, we're doing a bunch of stuff on game day, so that was going to be my late morning afternoon work. But what I can say is, if you're just looking at a blanket number, it's a little bit short, but you are dealing with the uncertainty of some COVID issues for Baltimore. What does Lamar Jackson look like in his return? We have seen COVID impact people differently. Some guys say, hey, you know, didn't impact me at all. And I've also had now like 2 weeks to rest my body. Other guys look like a shell of themselves with no energy. And you even had Myles Garrett say, like, this thing knocked me on my ass. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to play a full snap load. So what does that look like for Lamar Jackson? We're also waiting on Calais Campbell and Brandon Williams. Harbaugh insinuated that he thought things were trending positively. So if that's the case and you get back two key cogs on the defensive line for Baltimore, it certainly changes some things. Also some injuries in the back half that we'll have to monitor as well. So there's just a lot that we don't know quite yet. So I'm spending the afternoon digging into this game a little bit more. And if I come across anything massive, I'll tweet it out.
Sounds good. We always appreciate that. And even more reason for people to follow you, not just Dan Quinn and Anthony Lynn tirades, but that occasional nugget to help steer our listeners in a positive direction.
Follow Payne on Twitter. Speaking of positivity.
Oh, here we go.
I decided not to tweet about Vic Fangio last night. I noticed like the timeline was just, it felt like angry. I was just bashing coaches. So I'm like, I'm just going to not hit send on the Vic Fangio.
I figured you might have been asleep already at that point. We know you like to try and get to bed early on Sunday nights to get prepared and have your right mindset completely locked in for these Monday podcasts.
That's it. I did watch all of the game, but I did try to get to bed before midnight. Didn't work.
That's good.
I tried.
It's all about the intent and effort, even if the execution isn't quite there. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Go to FanDuel, sign up, use the promo code Bet the Board for your risk-free $1,000. Anything else, Payne, you'd like to share with our loyal listeners before we get a 48-hour break and come back at the college football grind on Wednesday, which has made me want to cry all fall long?
No, that's it. Somehow we didn't have a lot to talk about today, but it was extremely long.
Yeah, imagine
what happens.
Is there
any good college football games this week? Because it's getting tough sledding over there.
I mean, I know you're going to anxiously await our full-scale breakdown of Ohio State against Michigan with the Buckeyes a robust 29.5-point favorite for a game that may or may not get played.
It'll be really fun digging into that game and then watch it not happen. So can't wait for
that. You know, my whole thing is I think we just spend the entire podcast breaking down Miami and North Carolina, a game that means absolutely nothing now that the ACC has decided that Clemson and Notre Dame were going to go right to the conference championship.
Yep.
I will say one thing that is disappointing, though. The annual Army-Navy showdown gets stuck in the massive humanity, which is a full-blown college football slate, and it's not even on big-time CBS. It's been relegated to CBS Sports Network.
You remember a day and time when they used to open these totals in the mid-50s and then lower 50s? And here we are.
52.5, 53.5. You'd sit there pounding your fingers on the desk knowing that you could get an option game between two service academies, specifically Army, Navy in the low 50s. Yeah, I miss those days. They're about 3 years ago, I think.
41.5. Market is fully adjusted.
We'll find a couple of games. Not quite sure there's a whole lot that has major national championship implications, but at least this is one final week of the regular season before we get into conference championships, which will help shape the college football playoff. But before we get there, we have some NFL heavy lifting to be done. Let's get the 49ers to the promised land. And hopefully for you, all of our loyal listeners, for Payne and me included, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.